Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
This is 30 years in the making. I am actually really happy to be here with my old friend, Qua Nguyen. Qua is a person that I actually talk a lot about on the podcast. People have asked me how I got into the kind of the media world and the film business. And when I was at USC, Qua was doing his MFA in screenwriting. And little did I know at the time what a big deal that was, because it's very difficult to get those kind of programs at USC. And here we are, almost 30 years later, we're in Vietnam right now, and Qua is the program director for the film program at RMIT, which is the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast.
Thank you. Such an honor to be here, really. After 400 something episodes, I actually finally made the cut.
You know, I always wanted to have you on. But it was like, it has to be sort of like the right time, the right moment. And it's also like one of these things where like, I was under a certain count. And in order to like bring people on like you, who people, the world doesn't really know about, right?
Yeah.
You kind of have to have like a bigger count, like a bigger follower, subscriber count. So then when you bring on people that are like lesser known, it makes a bigger impact. I should have shared that with you many years ago, but
yeah,
that's sort of like the way I've been watching the trends of these things. So I asked you to come on because there's so many things, you know. You and my brother moved to Vietnam almost at the same time, about 20 years ago.
He came, I think, 6 months before I did.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've been here now officially since June, 20 years, and I think Conan is pushing 21.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. He came in February 2004, I think.
Okay, yeah.
I'll never forget that, yeah. So both of you left me to fend for myself in L.A. That was kind of... I should have went, you know, when I think about it. But we're here to talk about a lot of things. I want to talk to Qua a lot about his thoughts of moving to Vietnam. You know, that's something that I've always wanted to do. I've dreamt of doing. Hopefully one day I will do. And beyond just the whole idea of moving to Vietnam, I want to talk to Qua about film and filmmaking in Vietnam, the youth, because he's a professor at the University of RMIT here. And I think that there's so much information that I want to get to know today, even though we've hung out for some years together.
Sure, and happy to share it with the audience.
So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about your early days, because I've always was fascinated by the fact that you made it to West Point. You got into West Point.
I did.
Right?
I did get.
Today, I want to know a lot of about our regrets in the last 30 years, and a lot, not just regrets, but things that we did right, you know? So I think one of those things is, here we go with the sound.
No, this is Vietnam, right?
We are in Vietnam.
This is part of the environment, part of the soundscape of being in Vietnam.
So I wanna know, looking back, how the decision to not go through with West Point, did some point affect you? You know, when you were struggling in life, in times of distress, and did you ever look back and go, damn, I should have went to West Point?
I think it's always in the back of your mind, always. I mean, I think if anybody doesn't know what West Point is, it's the military academy for the Army. And so the only way that you can get into West Point is through a nomination. So you have to get a representative's nomination and a senator's nomination.
I did not know that.
Before you apply. And then you've got to always pass the physical and all that stuff so that you're...
So you had to go through all that? You got accepted.
Yes. Yeah,
so. And you turned it down.
Yeah.
What the heck did your mom and dad feel at the time?
Oh, man, they're...
I can't imagine.
Particularly my dad, you know, because my dad is a military man. And so he felt tremendous pride when I obviously I applied and went through the process and then got the nominations and then got in, got accepted, right? So full-on acceptance to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And it was a tough decision for me. One, I'd never been away from home. That would have required me to go, I think it's Maryland, right? Where West Point is. And, you know, at that time and all throughout my early years growing up, I had asthma. And so I was not the healthiest. And even when I did my physical, which was at the Presidio in San Francisco, I don't even know how I got accepted. Because I thought I'd failed the physical.
Because of asthma?
Because of asthma. And then there was this, they made you do exercises to see what your health was like. Yeah. And they made us run. And so imagine a bunch of guys lined up to do this run in this gymnasium, right? Back and forth. And I was in there with a bunch of really big dudes, like big, tall American Caucasian dudes and African Americans go. And I'm this, you know, relatively small Vietnamese guy. And we started running. And I'm like, and they're hauling butt.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just trying to keep up with him. And in trying to keep up with him, I was going faster in my mind than what my legs are actually doing, and I actually fell.
Wow.
I fell like two or three times. And my dad's like, dude.
Oh, he was there?
Yeah, he was there. He took me there. Because back then, you know, being in high school, I couldn't drive, right? So he took me there. And for sure, after seeing me fall and, you know, me falling, I felt like God's done. It's done. And then all of a sudden in the mail, a few months later, acceptance. And I think my dad at the time, my dad was shaking. He was so disappointed, you know, because we'd gone through all that whole process of getting the nomination and everything, writing letters to the center. They wrote back and they nominated me. Because I went to Vanden High School, which is the high school that is associated to Travis Air Force Base. So Travis Air Force Base is the first place that my father came to. Back in 1963, because he came to America to do Air Force training.
Yeah.
And so he was actually, when he came with Travis Air Force Base, was the first place he landed. And so as a result of that, after we moved up to San Jose from Los Angeles, he decided that, hey, you know, San Jose was a little bit too far because he was working kind of near there. He ended up working as an instrument technician for oil refineries. And so in that area, there were oil refineries. So we moved up there because it was the first place that he came to America. It was like, it'd be a good place for my kids to
settle.
Yeah.
It's crazy to hear this because I've never heard it. I've never heard the history. And I think about like the pride of a man who was in America in the 60s. Brings his kids here, and then the kid decides to not go to West Point, which is a huge deal for our parents. And then you decide
One thing, you know, if anybody knows, it's like if you get accepted into any of the military academies, whether it be Air Force Academy, Naval Academy, or West Point, it's a free education.
It's a huge deal.
So it's like over $200,000 amazing
education.
And so he was pretty heartbroken. But let me turn back to that story where I had fallen during this run and my dad was disappointed. I was disappointed. And then he turns to the military officer who was there organizing that kind of health check exercise. And he goes, he ain't gonna get it, is he? Yeah, my dad
asked. Said that.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, he's fallen, but he shows a lot of grit.
That's what the officer said?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's what got me into West Point was
wow, the grit.
I picked myself up and kept going. And then, you know, you've been a Marine, so you know how important grit is.
Yeah.
And at that time, when we're thinking,
you don't think about it that way.
We're thinking of excellence, yeah. Right? Like fastest guy, healthiest guy. But what they saw was he kept going. He had grit. This is a guy that we could potentially
train.
Put out there, and he'll just keep going. You know, even when he's challenged,
yeah.
He's just going to keep going. So on those merits alone, even though I failed the physical, I got accepted.
Save big money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
It's crazy to think how contrarian you are when you get all these opportunities, right? You got the West Point opportunity, you got the opportunity to stay in America, pursue film after USC, but you decide to like buck the system, you buck the channels, you go the opposite way.
Was it?
I don't know, man. Like, what well,
there are a few important factors, right? So one, the thing that I think is always missing, even though we're part of the Vietnamese community over there, we're part of the VSA, Vietnamese Student Association or Union, whatever they call it, depending on the school. There was still this thing that was kind of missing. Like, we mostly, even when we got together, how often did we speak Vietnamese, to be honest? Right? And so there was this kind of lack of connection.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, you did the VSA shows and you had the kind of traditional,
it's like a copy of a copy doing things. Yeah,
you always felt like, hey, I wanted to know the origin. I wanted to know like what it's truly like in Vietnam. And I think before we came back, it was still there was still a lot of unsureness of how we would be accepted, what the conditions were. And it wasn't until I think my parents came back, because they came back before. Obviously, before I did, they took trips. And then I was like, oh, I want to go, you know? And I think it was, I finally went back in, I want to say, no, 1998 or 99, something like that. And I was just blown away. Yeah, because I think, you know, growing up in the West, you have a certain preconceived notion of what Vietnam is like. Yeah. And you think rural, you think rice paddy. It's just like, because that's what we're learning from the textbooks. You learn that there's a war and it's still very, it's third world country. And
it obviously was. I mean,
yeah. And Vietnam went through some difficult time periods, especially during the subsidy period and then Noi Mai, you know. So it was going through all the growing pains. And so you had this notion of what it was. And then when we actually made the trip back, I made the trip back with my younger brother home and my parents for the first time. And I was just like, this is awesome. And I felt the connection.
Yeah.
I felt like, God, I really want to explore this. I want to really explore the Vietnamese side of me. And so I think by the time that, and we had after that, us as friends had taken trips back here to Vietnam.
Together.
2-week vacation, 14 days. Okay. And that was the inspiration for my first film,
14 days. Yeah.
And
starring Jin Hoi, by the way.
Yeah. And it just felt right. And every chance that we got, because in working in America, working corporate in America, you only get 2 weeks off, you know, to go anywhere. And so I just found myself saving up the 2 weeks to come back to Vietnam every year.
Yeah.
And at some point, you know, I think, and after Tom decided that he was going to move back, I think you guys had started a factory.
Yeah.
And he was going to come back to kind of supervise that and run that.
And that's what he did. He came back to supervise our family factory.
Yeah. And so I was like, it was a no-brainer. And I also, I have to admit, you know, being somebody who studied film and wanting to make movies, and I've always, without a doubt, always wanted to tell Vietnamese stories. Like, I never saw myself telling
a Vietnamese-American story.
Yeah, or even just American stories. Like, just get into the mainstream. And do I regret not going that direction? I don't know. I mean, I think I could have written just plain Hollywood type of stories, you know, romantic comedies and action films. But I always felt this drive to tell Vietnamese stories because there were so many stories, you know, us growing up in America, stories that we wanted to see on the screen, which very few and far in between. So every time, every year, there would be one Vietnamese film or two, and we'd all go see it. Mostly back then, it was like Vietnam War films.
Yeah, yeah. Until Three Seasons came out, that was when I think it changed a lot for many of us.
Yeah, it was obviously, for me, it was John and Holmes films first, right? Before. And then it was Three Seasons by Tony Boyd, because it was actually the first American film since post-war to be shot in Vietnam. And it was eye-opening. It was like, hey, we can make Vietnamese films now.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be cool to actually go back to Vietnam and tell these stories? Because then you kind of have an audience. Mm-hmm. You know, while we want to get our stories to an international audience, there's very few people who actually want to see Vietnamese films. And there is very little funding to make Vietnamese films in the U.S. And so when you grow up with all these young Vietnamese-American filmmakers, you realize that it doesn't add up. There's like 10 of us, and every year you get one Vietnamese film made. So how do we make it? We're fighting over this small piece of pie.
Yeah, yeah. But let me ask you this. So we all had this notion of like Vietnamese Americans going back to Vietnam to make movies. And you were definitely in the early wave with all these guys like Victor Vu, Hem Tran, Charlie Nguyen, all these early filmmakers. But let me ask you something though. The idea of Vietnamese Americans making Vietnamese films for Vietnam consumption, to me, looking back now, is a very hard proposition for any of us who are Vietnamese American. Why? Is because to understand Vietnamese and the language and to speak it and to direct in it, you have to kind of come from it, right? We are not that, right? We are the type of people that would make a movie like 14 Days because it comes from a different perspective of Vietnamese America, right? Now, looking back though, how do you feel about that now, knowing what you know about, because we talked about this in your podcast, about being able to understand what does it actually mean to understand the grammatical, to understand all of the idiomatic sides of the Vietnamese language. Now knowing all of this stuff, we talked about it. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's definitely a challenge, no doubt, because I think if you're a screenwriter and you write a screenplay in English, that's just like that version becomes the film. Obviously, it gets translated by the director, you know, in terms of their vision. But when you're doing it for a Vietnamese audience, then it goes through translation. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, there's a lot of things that
are lost in translation.
And so it was always kind of going back and forth. English version, because I write in English. I don't have the Vietnamese writing capacity to write purely in Vietnamese. So I write in English. At that time, I did my first draft in my own kind of Vietnamese version, you know? So I guess, what would you call it?
Vietlish?
Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right?
And then I give that to a local person to then
Vietnamese it?
Yeah, localize it even more.
Localize it.
But always through that localization, it then has to come back to English. And then I make more adjustments. Because, you know, obviously there's ways that you would say things or certain phrases. You can't translate things word for word or else it sounds awkward.
Yeah.
And so it's trying to figure out, well, what's the Vietnamese equivalent of how I would say it in English? And so I think even nowadays, I think even with Vietnamese films made by Vietnamese Americans, there's still a little bit of awkwardness. Yeah. And I'm told this by a lot of Vietnamese viewers that it still sounds, you know, kind of Vietnamese-American and not Vietnamese. So it's a process, and it actually, you know, makes screenwriting, I think, a lot more difficult. It takes a lot more time. And of course, we want to do it authentically. We want to do it right. We don't want to offend the local audience. So we're always trying our best, but we know that we can almost never get there.
We can never get there. The chasm is so wide, right? That bridge to cross. I mean, because not only are you dealing with like grammar and syntax and idioms, real tools in the Vietnamese language versus the English language, there's this also crossover into the actual mentality of a Vietnamese human being that you can't grasp. We can't.
Yeah.
And I feel like I know a lot about Vietnamese culture and blah, 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 but I'm still never going to be a Vietnamese local, nor am I going to be fully American.
Exactly. Exactly. Right?
So where does that leave us now as these people who are like third culture Vietnamese American, you know, kids out in the world?
Yeah. Yeah. And you bring up a good point in that third culture, cultural hybrid in a way. We're not quite there. We're not quite here, but we're somewhere in between. But that's kind of the position that I take even for, you know, my PhD in screenwriting is that I bring something quite unique to the table because of that. And hopefully that comes out in the types of stories that I embrace, that I decide to tell. And also the certain perspective in which I tell it through these characters.
And the for me, when I look at that and I hear what you say, I always think about the numbers, right? Because when you can write a movie like Dung Tan and kind of portray the trials and tribulations of Vietnamese person living in Vietnam, and it hits four quadrants, right? When we put something out there that's very unique and you're a good storyteller, you can structure things, you have your own soul into the writing, but it doesn't hit on an economic level for guys like us who are, like, even this podcast.
You have Victor, who's done really well. He's Vietnamese American.
He's crossed over, yeah. He's arguably, but his Vietnamese is like tip top, like in the last few years.
I would say his and Charlie's, they have really good Vietnamese.
And that's like, that's the necessity.
Yeah.
Is that it?
But they also, you know, not to let the cat out of the hat, they also have a really trusted team that they work with that will help them further localize it. And I think that's needed too, because there are things that we won't get exactly right, and that team will help us, support us in getting it. And I wouldn't say that I haven't found it in that sense in terms of collaborators, because I've been fortunate to meet young people who also have an interest in screenwriting, and they've kind of helped guide me, in certain areas. And then obviously I'm married to a Vietnamese, and she's helped me quite a bit.
Let me ask you about this proximity to young Vietnamese at school who speak perfect English, by the way. You're working with them throughout the last few years. How much change and progress have you seen in the young people who are making movies today? What's the delta? What's the change that you've seen in the last few years?
I think obviously now things like YouTube, you know,
equalizes the language and
it democratizes everything, because now they have access. And the fact that they understand English makes it even more powerful for them, because now they can watch all these podcasts, they can watch tutorials really easy, so they can pick up all of the skills that they need to really advance themselves as filmmakers, and they do. And you could tell. I think the one area of shortcoming is still the storytelling, and I think part of the reason is that because of the way that they're brought up, storytelling maybe isn't emphasized as much in Vietnamese education, and becoming a writer is not emphasized.
So it's not there's the
more
muscle.
Practical. There's more practical careers that Vietnamese parents want you to follow.
Right, right.
And so they don't gravitate towards doing that.
And it's a muscle that you have to constantly work
out. Yeah, yeah.
Storytelling is a muscle.
Yeah. So they don't come across, you know, maybe creative writing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think they write essays and everything, yeah. but they don't come across creative writing until they get into
much later, yeah.
And it's and more so, analytical writing, I think, in high school and college. But creative writing is its own devil.
Yeah. And so they find it awkward, and it takes time. It takes time. It takes craft. It takes years and years of continuous writing to then develop
avoid
strategies for how you might tell a story.
Yeah.
To plot things out and to be able to move people with your words. I'm not saying that's true with everybody, you know, because I find that there are young writers who are amazing. I think there are really a lot of talented poets too, but I think poetry is something that's more accessible early, more
here, you know.
Yeah, I mean more text that they can read. They can read Vietnamese poetry. They can read Vietnamese stories. But how often do they get access to Vietnamese screenplays?
Wow! Oh wow!
Right. So screenplay is a very specialized way of writing.
Yeah,
and so they don't get that until they actually arrive at university, and if they're studying film, then they'll take some screenwriting courses. And so at the beginning, it's a lot of paint by numbers, you know. I learned these things, I want to paint that way. And so I don't think until they leave university and have more life experiences. That's another note too.
Life experiences, reading,
and reading.
Reading is very lacking, I think, and I think even in America.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's lacking in young people, period.
Yeah. Being exposed to a lot of different stories, yeah. right?
Yeah.
To be able to then sit down and tell your own story and tell it well.
And it's a numbers game, because if you have a lot of people vying for spots at USC, NYU, UCLA, LMU, Chapman, these film universities, right? The top five, you know, that come to my head may not be the top five, but these are the ones that come to my mind. Because of their proximity to these big city storytellers, you know, Hollywood, New York. If you're not in that space, then you're not really training to be a storyteller. So it's a numbers game. There's so many people that are trying to get to those five universities that they're working on their craft like earlier in their lives. Vietnam is not at that level at numbers wise to have that many young people trying to train to get into the West Points of the film industry here in Vietnam. And that's a problem, because they're not thinking that that's a possibility yet.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's, because it's very easy when you're exposed to a lot of media to then want to tell stories that are maybe not Vietnamese. And it's also sometimes being embedded here, you don't see things the way that maybe somebody who maybe comes from overseas sees things, or sees certain beauties and that sort to tell those stories.
Yeah.
And so I hope that, you know, through film schools here, through different types of workshops that are run here, and, you know, there's obviously a lot of not only overseas Vietnamese who come back to share, but also the local filmmakers here who are doing competitions and
winning to
share how you go about doing this. And but I think the young people here are super talented. Like, technically you don't see a difference,
right.
And I would say some of the works that our students have done, if you compare it to the international the films that are done internationally by students, they're neck and neck. But where it falls short is still storytelling, how to nail that down. But it's getting there. It's getting there. And I see progress every year. I see a lot more young people start to gravitate towards screenwriting, towards storytelling, because they realize that that's going to be the difference maker, you know, because once you have everything kind of democratized, then you can meet, you can match what's happening out there technically.
Yeah.
But what's going to be the thing that separates you? It's the stories.
You know, we talked a lot about the good things, the aspects of moving to Vietnam that are amazing. And I think that's a natural thing. I like to hear those things. But I also like to hear the bad things. The things that you regret, because I think that's sort of like the title of like what brought me here. But in the beauty of the regrets and the harsh stories, I think we can find beauty in the lessons that you're about to, you know, unleash. Because I want to know, if you look back on the 20 years that you were here, what are some of the things that you regret?
Okay. I mean, number one, you know, is obviously being away from my family. Because my for all the time that I've been here and until very recently when...
Your mom and dad moved here.
Yeah, I moved back. I was away from my parents. And so all those years of missing out on really getting to know them, because then, you know, you're always over the screen. I feel regret in that I could have spent more time with them. I could
have. That's not a Vietnamese thing. Think about it. Like all these kids that are growing up in Orange County and they have to move to, you know, Minnesota, Wyoming, or Dakotas to do work. You know, they're working in the oil industry, whatever. Everybody's moving away from their parents. I mean, I think that's a very life thing. That's, yes, moving to Vietnam might be that regretful thing, but I think you would have had to deal with that if you were in the military, right? If you, whatever the thing that you did, if you were a filmmaker living in LA, they were still living in San Jose. So that's one thing that Tom or you can't change.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But
that's a regret.
That's a regret, because had we stayed, I think, had I stayed in the US, I would have most likely gravitated near them or be in a distance where I could see them more often and hopefully, you know, spend more time with them. But I'm very fortunate to have had, you know, I got the last 6 months.
Your dad's life.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad's life. And he got to meet my kids. My kids got to know, you know,
their grandpa
and grandfather. And now obviously they're still spending time with our grandmother. So it's awesome that I got those last 6 months with my dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And
another regret.
Another regret would be,
I mean, this doesn't even have to be a regret. It's more like, what would you do differently looking back in the 20 years of moving here?
I don't think I would have. Had I stayed in the US, I probably wouldn't have been in the film industry. That's the honest truth. Because obviously I was working as an engineer, right? A network engineer at what was SBC, Pac Bell, and SBC, and then now it's AT&T.
I would have all of that.
I probably would have continued working there. I had all of the friends that I worked with are mostly still there.
Yeah.
And so I could have probably most likely continued doing that. And probably writing, you know, in my free time. I don't think I would have made the films I made had I stayed in the U.S. Because, as I told you, there wasn't a lot of opportunity given the number of young Vietnamese American filmmakers and the number of films that actually got produced.
Who knows, right?
Yeah, who knows? But I don't have much regret because I've obviously...
You've built a beautiful life here.
Yeah, I can't complain.
Yeah.
I can't complain. I've reconnected with being Vietnamese. I don't think I would know the language as well. I don't think I would I wouldn't have the sentiments that I have now. I think I would have been definitely more American than Vietnamese. And so I guess I've benefited the best of both worlds. I still love the Vietnamese side of me, which I've obviously gotten more of living here, but I also have a very American side. So I still love American food, hamburgers,
sports,
songs. I love sports. I love American football. I keep in touch with my friends through sports. So I play fantasy football, even though I'm a 54-year-old man.
Yeah.
But that, for me, it's not just about engaging that, it's just reconnecting with friends that I have in the US.
Yes, yeah.
And so,
you know, there's this idea of, you just brought up something that I'm thinking about a lot, is that our kids going away to college, right? I've asked several people now who are highly successful in their 70s and have superstar kids, right? Who go off to, you know, LA. They're from the East Coast. They send their kids off to LA or New York wherever. And I've asked several people now, like our parents' generation. I go, looking back, all that time away, you guys sacrificed everything to get your family and then have kids in America for them to like take off and leave. How many years, 30, 40, 50 years of not being together? Looking back, would you have queen kit? Would you have motivated your children, encouraged them to go to these big Ivy schools or these colleges that were far from you because it launched their lives and lived very far from you?
Yeah.
And you know what they all say to me? You go, no, I'd rather keep them close. I'd rather...
Really?
I'd rather have my children. Every one of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because think about it. Like, you have these kids, right?
You gave them wings and they
wings and they flew and they don't really ever come back.
Yeah.
And then you see this really different version of what you thought was going to be these kids, but they've turned into Americans. They've turned into Vietnamese Americans who left to Vietnam. And then like, when you think about it, cause this, I've talked to, like I said, all these people. And then I've asked my mom the same thing. And she said, definitely do not encourage your kids to go off to college in some far, you're going to lose them forever.
Mm.
She was,
so that's her regret then? Would you say that's a regret?
I think it is definitely my mother's regret about Tom.
Okay.
Definitely a regret about setting up that factory in our family. And I had to anchor it but with sales in LA. And then he had to anchor the factory with the design and the texture of the textiles that we make.
Yeah.
And then he left to Vietnam and set up shop as a VFX supervisor, animator guy, kind of guy.
Yeah.
Lost her son. 20 years of no real interaction, unless it's like once a year, once a really... Tom comes home, what, every 2 to 3 years?
Yeah.
It's a painful thing. And when I'm like thinking about my children, I'm like, I don't know if I want my... I don't know. I want to be separated from the kids.
You don't want to be, right?
I don't want to be separated from... Yeah. That's why I don't want to move back to Vietnam, because I don't want to be separated from my kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How do you feel?
I think for me, being an older dad, right? That's the whole premise of my show.
Yeah.
Is eventually, you know, I'm going to have to part ways with them earlier than I would want to. And
you mean like you're going to leave the earth earlier than any other
dad? Obviously. Obviously, if I had kids when I was in my 20s, I would actually spend a lot more time with them, right? Barring accident, barring other things, than having them in my 40s and knowing that in, let's just say, being realistic, like if I can live as long as my father, which now will be, he left the world at 83, right? And I'm 54, so we're 29 more years.
That's a long time. It's a long time. It's just 29 more years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
29 more years.
He did a fabulous job of staying alive to 83.
No. Amazing. Amazing.
Amazing.
So if we get there, because we don't know, yep. Right? The goal is to get there and go beyond. But who knows? Everybody's life is different. And that's why I think at this stage, you and I are very into fitness to make sure, because we have kids when we're older.
In our 40s.
To make sure that we prolong ourselves to be there with them. But so I'm already of the mindset, because even at being, if I get to my 80s, I'm not going to be in a position to help them out much. They're going to be having to take care of me. And so I feel like whatever is good for them, if that means being away, would I want to be far away from them? No. At least that's how I feel now. Who knows, you know, in 10, 15 years, 20 years, how I feel. But I want them to do whatever they love to do and to find their way, because eventually they'll have to. And so I'm of the mindset and you know, this is a conversation you don't have often with your wife, right? But I know that she and I, my wife and I are very far apart in age, 21 years. And I tell her that, hey, you know, there's a really strong possibility that when I move on, you're still going to be very young. I tell her that, you know, if you find love again, then by all means, because you got to keep living.
Yeah.
So I'm already prepared.
Letting go of that.
Yeah, I'm not going to be controlling and say, you can't have another partner. That's but she's still that. Got, she's still got a whole life to live. And if she finds love with somebody, then by all means, you know. Because we only live once, right? As far as we know. So live your life the way that you need to. So I'm all about that. So I don't, while I want my kids to be near me, it's up to them. It's really up to them and where life takes them, where opportunities take them, where love takes them.
Yeah.
I'm open to that. You know?
That's a wonderful answer, because I'm a lot more toxic than you when it comes to that. And I definitely need to change my perspective. I mean, I'm so in love with my children, you know, because they're so cute and they're so beautiful. And, you know, you and I waited for such a long time to have our kids, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's such a privilege. It's such a wonderful state of being to have these angelic beings in our lives, you know? I can't.
Wait, but you also have to accept this, that at some point they could say, well, I don't want to be near you. And you have to accept that, right?
But damn, that's why you got to live a life where you really dial in being a good.
But even when you dial in, like, my parents were amazing parents.
Yeah.
And somehow
life just takes you.
Yeah, you know, I had happy feet and I went far away from
them. Yeah.
And I don't think I'm a bad kid, and they're not bad parents. They're amazing parents, but it's just the flow of life, you know? And do I have regrets? Yeah, I wish I could have stayed close to them and spent more time with them. And I'm trying to, and I don't think you can ever make up for it, but I'm enjoying the time that I have with my mom right now. And we just make the best of it.
Yeah. I want to talk about the Vietnamese film industry as you see it today. I want to ask you, I see a lot of good movies coming out of Vietnam. I see a lot of wonderful things. And I think about the U.S. and I think about how the economies are different. And I'm talking about theatrical economy, streaming economy, thinking about films that are made in America. The viewing practices are now going a lot to streaming. Whereas here in Vietnam, you still have a huge theatrical market. But would that ever change?
Everything changes. And I'll let you in on a little secret. This is my evaluation, right? And I don't know if it holds true with every country, but this is my own observation. I think it will hold for a while.
Yeah.
I think theatrical will still be very popular here because, for one, Vietnamese people just love to go out, right? They don't want to stay at home. And I think why it's kind of died down in
America,
other parts of the world, is that young people end up living on their own really early. Okay?
Oh, that makes sense.
So when they're 18, they're out, they're living on their own. They can
consummate.
They can, yes, they can bring their girlfriends home at any
Netflix
time.
And chill.
And now TVs are huge. It's like you get the theatrical experience at home and you can watch it at any time, you know? So, you know, the funny thing is, like, in the past, it was the two leading brands for TVs were Samsung and LG. But recently, number two, do you know who number two is? Became?
Sony? No. Netflix or Amazon?
TCL.
Who's TCL?
TCL is a Chinese brand. But they're able to deliver TVs for so cheap. Wow. So you can get a giant TV for so little.
Here in Vietnam?
Well, anywhere. In the US.
I might even have a TCL.
And so people, you know, who now live on their own can bring their fam or their friends and their girlfriends home. Well, of course, just watch it at home, watch streaming, rather than go to the theaters where you got to pay heavy ticket prices and pay for expensive popcorn and drinks. You can do that all at home for so much less. Whereas in Vietnam, when you're living with your parents, you aren't bringing your friends home. You're not bringing your girlfriends home or boyfriends home.
Not doing that.
So you have to go out. And so
that's why the numbers.
That's why I think it's
observation.
Dude, what do you think?
I think it's a great. I think it's a great point. I never. You know, I always thought it was the heat. But if you're inside, you're in AC.
Yeah.
So it's not the heat.
Yeah.
In fact, you don't even want to go to the theaters because you have to traverse the heat. But that family structure is a brilliant. Yeah, I never thought about that.
Yeah, so you gotta go out. That's why many hotels do so well.
That makes sense, man. It makes sense.
Yeah. And we all know that, you know, I mean, being young, you're gonna have boyfriends and girlfriends.
Yeah.
And so you gotta go out.
So it's the organization of society here. It's organized very differently.
Yeah. So I think it's as long as children or young adults still live with their parents, they generally do so until they get married or after they get
married. It's expected here that you maintain multi-generational living.
Yeah. And so they gotta go out. Heck, that's why theatrical is still, I think, very big. And
yeah.
Vietnam, and that's good for us who are filmmakers.
Yeah. It's still a huge contribution to production costs, you know, to be able to have that theatrical number. Because, I mean, let's face it, I think streaming is really cannibalizing the film industry in America.
Absolutely. And just the way that you monetize on streaming, it's very... it's not very good.
No, it's horrible.
So hence,
it's horrible.
You kind of need that.
Because with streaming, they have all the power.
Yeah.
They have all the power. It's like our platform is where all the eyeballs go. We don't really need your content. We can make our own in-house content.
Yeah.
But it's just like, remember in the early days of the studio system and monopoly, right? Anti-monopoly rules in America. It's like... The production companies and the studios could not own exhibition.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there you would inherently mess up the distribution model and you would cannibalize the system. And what happens is if you controlled it vertically, which is now what we're seeing with Netflix or Amazon or Hulu,
yeah.
If you control it, it's over.
Yeah.
Because now you're gonna create situations where you can't have competition come in.
Yeah.
Yep. Scary. It's, you know, it's these early business people who came in and blocked the anti-monopoly rules of theatrical and separated production studio models understood something very much about the model of vertically integrated situations.
Yeah.
And now here we are.
So now you're just going to fall into the hands of a few big players. And so that's why, like, the only types of films that get people to go to the theater are kind of these tentpole films, blockbuster films, huge visual effects, stars.
But in Vietnam, though, all this stuff is still vertical because the production companies own theaters. So wait, we're going back to the model of... I'm actually disqualifying my earlier argument about it being... a bad thing for the film industry. Because in Vietnam, production companies own theaters. Galaxy owns, Latte owns, all these production houses and studios own their own theater chains. BHD, all of them arguably are vertically integrated and are different from the model that I'm talking about. So I don't know. I don't know how this is all playing out, but...
Yeah, I mean, it still makes it tough for a small film here. You know, a more indie type film to kind of make it through, because obviously over here you don't get a set number of days where you're guaranteed a showing in a theater. So if you go in a theater and you don't perform well in that first weekend, you're
out.
You're not gonna last very long.
But are there movies that make their own, produce their own, do they get to keep it longer?
So if they've produced it, then obviously in their chain, they'll keep it longer.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, absolutely. It might, you know, drop out of the other chains, you know.
Yeah, but they can keep their
own. But obviously, they've got to make back,
you know, their own.
Yeah, at least the cost of the film, right? To some extent, because it will reach a point where you just have empty theaters. And then you're like, okay, right. I've got to cut it loose.
This is diminishing returns. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think what's nice here in Vietnam is that there is still that opportunity. If people are daring to just continue to make films, because obviously production costs here are a lot lower.
Yeah.
And it might take that one kind of special film, one or two special film that maybe is done on a super low budget to then have amazing, you know,
numbers, yeah,
astronomical success.
And that
might open
possible.
Up the
that's still
the doors.
Vietnam.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
can still make a movie far below what like $1 million is what it costs to make a decent movie here in Vietnam. You could still make a movie for like $400,000 or $500,000 and get away with some, you know, you can get away with making a lot of profit at the box office.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, not in the way of like, or in the way of like a Blair Witch Project or something like that.
It's possible. We don't know. I don't think people have tested the market enough. And obviously, some of the theater chains, they always want to prioritize their yeah. projects. So again, it comes down to that opening weekend. Can I get the word of mouth out to enough people so that they come that first weekend to then give you a second weekend and so on and so forth?
So we've covered the gamut. We've talked about, which is what I wanted to come and talk about, is like any regrets. But now I want to ask you in closing, what do you feel were the great things about your decision to move to Vietnam?
I got to live out my dream of being a filmmaker. So screenwriter, directed my first film after 10 years. So the rule of thumb when you finish film school and they tell you before you leave that the reality is that it takes about 10 years before you make your first feature film.
Wow.
And at that time, when you go to film school to make feature films or get into television writing. At least when I went to school, those were kind of like the only two avenues. And when I directed my first feature film, which was 14 Days, which you mentioned, we're starring Jit Hoi and Tai Hua, it was exactly 10 years from the time that I graduated.
Wow.
And so I feel at least fulfilled in that area. That I was able to direct a film and a second film, and then I had another screenplay that I wrote produced. So I've lived that part of the dream. Now, have I had the success like Charlie and Victor and Ham and those guys? Probably not the success that they've had as filmmakers. But I've also segued or transitioned to being an academic.
Yeah, education. Yeah.
And I've found that extremely fulfilling. I'm seeing now students that I taught, you know, 10, 15, you know, because now I've taught for 16 years, right? They're starting to reach success. They are winning awards as cinematographers, as just filmmakers. They've got their own companies. And they've established a name for themselves. So I'm really proud of that. And part of the series that I'm doing is Where Are They Now? Where I'm interviewing young people that I've taught and catching up with them to see where they've advanced to since leaving university. And so I'll be doing a lot more episodes on that. But I'm really proud of the fact that I've been able to contribute a little bit to the how Vietnam has progressed. And maybe not in a huge way in the sense that, you know, in the science or engineering field, but in the arts, you know, in the types of stories that are told, how people are contributing to telling the stories of Vietnam in many different facets, whether it be through television commercials, feature films, web series, whatever. I think I've done that. And I'm now finishing up my PhD in screenwriting. So, and I think it's always been in the cards because my name, Trọng Khoa, is a name that my mother gave me and it means to value education. And so in a way I'm living out my name.
Yeah.
And I do truly embrace it. I value education. And I like to share my knowledge with others through, you know, not only my teaching, but through now YouTube.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. And so I'm proud of where, you know, I've been able to go. And again, it's never over. Like, I think I still have a few stories left in me.
Yeah, no.
I can always return back to filmmaking. Right now, I'm more focused on teaching others, but also raising a young family, you know?
You're the head of the department at the film program at RMIT, right?
Yeah.
Right? This is, like, you are the one who controls sort of like the curriculum, the program of what film students are going through at RMIT to experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's a journey that you and I have gone. I mentioned in the beginning of the episode that Kwa was really the one who was the first one in my life to suggest that I become a producer. And I didn't even know what the hell that was. I'm in the Marines and I thought I'd go to law school and
what am I going to produce?
Yeah. But even I didn't even know what the hell that was. And, you know, a little background about Kwa was that at the time, I think you were working at Alphaville for Roy Lee, or you had just come out of working for this mega producer now today. He's a Korean producer called, his name is Roy Lee. And didn't he bring like a Ring and all these?
Yeah, so he brought a lot of remakes from Asia. So he was the one who said, okay, there are all these amazing films, particularly in the horror genre, that I can bring to the US and then have them remade into American films. And The Ring is a perfect example.
Yeah.
I think Shudder, there's a lot of Korean and Japanese horror that he brought here.
Yeah.
He's huge. Yeah, he's still a huge producer.
Yeah, and he's, I mean, if you guys look it up, Roy Lee has made crazy, crazy amounts of movies that have done very well. So Kwa had told me about Roy Lee, and Kwa had mentioned that, hey, maybe the way to start is to start at the agency route. I had always been I love to read, and I always thought, I was actually a closeted writer my entire life.
Okay.
Yeah. Always wanted to write, but I don't have that discipline, and you know, it's always been a difficult thing. But going through what you had suggested to me is agency route, then work as a PA on a set, work as a development assistant at the film companies, the production companies. And once you get sort of like this basic view of the entire industry, then you can go out and one day produce. And here we are. Here it is today. I mean, between podcasting and producing is kind of how I spend my time. So thank you so much for the advice in our early years. And here we are.
Yeah, and the thing is, the one thing, if anybody knows Ken, you know, you have to embrace the fact that he's super outgoing. He's always connecting people. He's always out there shaking hands and meeting people. And I go, this guy's perfect for being a producer because he's not afraid to walk up to a stranger. And even then, back then, remember when we went to go see Three Seasons, we're like, oh, Three Seasons is screening here. We gotta go and check it out. And then we saw, hey, there's this guy who's wearing this baseball cap. He's sitting in the back and I think he's somehow associated to the film. And then you just walked up to him, connected, and then after that we went out to eat.
Well, right? I mean, believe it or not, that let me tell you a story. Believe it or not, I actually did my research before the film, right? I knew there were two brothers, Bowie brothers, Tony and Tim. I did my research and I had watched the movie Three Seasons 2 weeks before. So I'm like, I'm going to go.
Hey, you went with your parents first, right?
Yeah. Well, we went with our parents. My parents to the second one. To the second one. Because the first one was screened at USC, I think. Screened at SC.
Okay.
And I knew going to this one, I was like, it was for me planned. It was planned. I'm like, I'm willing to not watch it the second time to make sure that I connect with one of them. So I turn and I look in the back and I see the guy in the hat, you know, glasses. All incognito, I knew it was Tim Bowie. So 15 minutes into the film, he goes to the bathroom, and then I go follow him. I follow the guy, I follow Tim, and Tim and I stop in the hallway. He's like, I'm like, hey, you know, I have you, Kwa, my brother, the three of us were still students at USC. We want to pursue film. Will you spend some time with us after this movie? And he's like, no. He's like, what a weirdo, right? Like, you just can't just roll up. Like, now I know. You just don't roll up to, you know, filmmakers like that or anybody in the business and do that. But I did it. And he said no. He said no to me. He's like, no, I have to actually go back to my girlfriend. And, you know, I go, no, you don't understand. You're visiting my town. I'm from here. I will give you all the X, Y's, and Z's, the access to, you know, the clubs and all of the things that, you know, all of the shenanigans that I was living at the time. I'll like open these doors up for you. And I know you're just like, you've been only here for a few years. And I was like partying hard at that time. And so he gets back on the phone and calls his girlfriend. He's like, all right, where are we going? And then we went to Cantor's, me and Tom to Cantor's. And I tell that story several times. And this is the person that actually was with me that night that really changed our lives. Because at that point, we just started to kind of like, all of us had this big community with within the Vietnamese film industry in those early years. It was in the late 90s. So thanks again for being there in my life at that time, giving me these suggestions, helping me along the way, telling me what movies to watch, like scripts, and really sharpening my kind of understanding of what makes a good movie.
Yeah, and you know, obviously you've been a part of my journey as well, and it's helped me to realize a lot about myself. Shortcomings as well, lots of shortcomings that, you know, and in life we're continually working on these things. But the fact is, you know, we've done it together, even though, you know, we don't spend a whole lot of time together because obviously you live in America and I live here. But we're always connected. And every time we see each other, it's like, anaem, right? Brothers.
And, I literally see my brother.
Yeah. And so I've always loved the fact that Ken is unafraid. You know, he's unafraid of challenging situations, raising his hand, going out there, making the connections. And I think that all this has happened naturally to where you've kind of entered and pivoted to doing this amazing podcast that you do. Because now you're putting your voice out there and you're connecting people as you've always done. And I'm just proud and happy to see you, you know, become successful at it.
Thanks, man. We got another 30 years to do this. So we got a long journey ahead of us. We're just getting started.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
For sure, man.
And hopefully, you know, down the road, we'll keep popping up on each other's shows.
Yeah. Tell everybody about your two shows. Quad just started his YouTube journey. Tell everybody so where we can find you.
Yeah. So on December 25th, Christmas Day, my wife and I decided to start a YouTube channel called Matt Jab, Oh Yeah, or Young Mom, Old Dad. And the reason why we started it was because it was after my father passed away, we just noticed my mom and her situation and being alone. And then my wife said, oh God, because of this age gap that we have, what am I gonna do? Because she's been an amazing mother and housewife all this time. Like, what's gonna happen if something happens to me? So what can she do? So then she decided that, you know, I like cooking. I'll go to cooking school. And so she went to cooking school learning Western cuisine. And after she graduated, it's like, well, what are we going to do? Like, are we going to open up a restaurant? And you've been in the restaurant business. You know how challenging that is. And I think your words of encouragement is don't do it. and so we're like, what are we going to do? You know, is she going to go and work for somebody like as a cook? But then that would be nights and weekends away from the kids. And I said, why don't you just start this YouTube channel? And so she started to share her cooking on YouTube channel. And since then, we've been doing that for 7 months and it's kind of getting some traction. We're trying to just grow it organically. And through it, she's developed her own voice and way to tell stories and to share her cooking and just the confidence, you know? Yeah. I was also on that channel, but obviously sharing my content, talking about doing these walk and talks, interviewing people, friends that I know who've been here a long time and now obviously interviewing you and interviewing students. And we felt that, and this is your advice as well, being the YouTuber, the experienced YouTuber that he is now, hey, you shouldn't be mixing your topics because that's going to throw off the algorithm.
Yep.
And so hence I've pivoted to create my own channel called Old Dad Discovers, where then I can get into this kind of podcasty type content that doesn't impact, you know, the viewers who want to just view cooking.
That's right.
And so hence I've pivoted, and there's going to be a lot of growing pains in doing this, but I feel like it's the right decision. And then it's also given my wife some autonomy to do the show that she wants to do and continue to build that. And I'm going to continue to do this.
And thank you so much for tuning in. And we'll put Kwa's YouTube link in the description below, and come over to his channel and hit subscribe if you haven't already done so. Thank you all for tuning in.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Finish up projects with GE-branded silicone sealants. Tub and tile silicone is 100% waterproof and offers same-day water readiness, making it perfect to use in kitchens and bathrooms. Shop our selection of GE sealants in-store and on Menards.com and save big. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to view all of our other great deals happening this week. Save big.